election in Ohio was a shambles. It was a complete fraud. I believe that many crimes were committed by governmental officials in Ohio, and I think the election should be set aside and a new election ordered.
Hello again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Rita Sand. Although the mainstream media maintains a strict silence over voting irregularities in the 2004 presidential elections, observers on the ground before and during the election, as well as those investigating the vote, have found clear evidence of fraud. We'll hear some of the stories of irregularities in Ohio, as well as give you an overview of present recount plans. We'll also hear about Liza Featherstone's new book on a landmark workers' rights lawsuit against Walmart. And we'll continue our coverage of a recent conference on nuclear power in Chicago. But first, a few headlines. On November 9th, hundreds of students, teachers, and supporters of Senn High School in Chicago marched from the school to Alderman Mary Smith's office in an attempt to stop plans to convert part of Senn High School into a naval academy. In fall of 2005, the Navy plans to take over a wing of the building, including more than a third of the school's science labs. The conversion to a charter military school is part of Chicago Public Schools' Renaissance 2010, and supporters say it would crowd out many existing programs at Senn, including the Junior Academy and the International Baccalaureate, which awarded more diplomas in 2004 than any school in the city after Lincoln Park. For more information, go to www.savesenn.org. On December 1st, Chicago City Council is set to vote on an ordinance that will fund CAN-TV, Chicago's cable access network. Comcast, the city's largest cable provider with 85% of the market, opposes the ordinance, which will increase their contribution to CAN-TV's budget to 65%. The cost is expected to be passed on to consumers, who should see their amusement tax on their cable bills rise about 15 cents a month. CAN-TV's future has been tenuous since cable TV provider RCN filed for bankruptcy and defaulted in their payment to CAN-TV. For more information, go to CAN-TV.org. And Chicago Indie Media's website is down. The server that operates Chicago's Indie Media Center, as well as New York City's and a handful of others, is in repair. We hope to have the site up this week. In the meantime, you can post articles on any indie media site. The closest ones are St. Louis, Madison, and Michigan. On November 5th, hundreds of demonstrators protested on the steps of the Ohio State Capitol in Columbus, despite police attempts to make them disperse. But you won't see this on the nightly news. You have to go to Cleveland's indie media site. The mainstream media has adopted a see-no-evil, hear-no-evil, report-no-evil policy when it comes to the 2004 presidential election, despite over 200,000 reports of voting irregularities. Most of the reports came from the battleground states of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida, and New Mexico. At Michigan's indie media site, you can view a short movie made by volunteers for the Video the Vote project.
I've been voting here at this location for almost the last 10 years.
I have registered, and now they're telling me that they don't have it.
I get here today. For some reason, my name is not on the list.
Like I say, I want to vote, and I'm going to vote.
The film shows white Republican challengers hassling African-American voters in polling places and hanging out in front of the poll after being asked to leave. And it shows longtime voters forced to use provisional ballots.
And they tried to send me from here to go over there so that my vote wouldn't count for the provisional.
Ray Beckerman is an attorney from New York City who volunteered to man a hotline run by the Ohio Democratic Party in Columbus. From Sunday, October 31st, through Election Day, he fielded about 80 calls, many of them before the polls opened. Beckerman says he received countless calls from people who registered by mail 2 and 3 months in advance in the Cleveland area, but their names never made it to the voting rolls. He describes the calls he got from longtime voters who were inexplicably dropped from voting rolls, although their names appeared on public lists of registered voters. And he received calls from frustrated voters who never received their absentee ballots.
I received an anonymous report from someone that a Republican friend of his received three absentee ballots and voted with all three of them. Now, I don't know enough about the procedures to know if someone could have gotten away with that or not, but it's interesting that a Republican got three absentee ballots, and the Democrats did. Many of the Democrats never got their absentee ballots at all.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Board of Elections people were discouraging people from voting, not telling them. Now, this is in the Democratic precincts again, telling them that if they show up, they won't be permitted to vote, and never telling them about the provisional ballots. You know, they were supposed to tell people, if you think you're entitled to vote, and you're not, then you could file provisional ballot. But they wouldn't tell black people that. They wouldn't tell people who lived in Cleveland that. Or, you know, I mean, it was just like such an obvious pattern the way things were. Now, on election day, there were very, very long lines only in Democratic areas. The news media, you know, have been bizarre in that they, you know, the day after the election, they showed some long lines and didn't, you know, just accepted that as if, oh, everything went smoothly, just some people had to wait on a long line. It wasn't some people. It was by design. In, you know, it only happened in African-American neighborhoods. The really long lines only happened in African-American neighborhoods. And it didn't happen by accident. It happened because they reduced the number of voting machines in those areas, even though it was an increased turnout expected.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't because maybe there were malfunctions of machines,
no.
So that they had to take them offline?
No. The facts are coming out now. In Knox County, which is a rural area, there were two precincts. Now, in one precinct, for 378 registered voters, there were two voting machines. In the adjacent precinct, for 2,000 voters, there were two voting machines. This was within the same Board of Elections and the same county.
Mm-hmm.
The only difference between these two precincts being that the one with 378 voters was a rural, solidly Republican area, and the other, although rural, was a college town. It was Gambier, Ohio, where Kenyon College is located, mm-hmm. where there were numerous college students and professors that Blackwell anticipated voting Democratic.
Beckerman is referring to Kenneth Blackwell, the Republican Secretary of State in Ohio, and also head of Ohio's Bush reelection team.
So the people in Knox County in Gambier, Ohio, waited as long as 11 hours to vote. That's the county where I spoke to this young man who had gotten online at 11:30 in the morning. He voted at 7 p.m. And when he left, the line was 150 voters longer than when he had arrived. And the last vote was cast in Knox County at 4 a.m. And at one point in the night, the election workers tried to convince these people to file provisional ballots. In other words, take away their right to have their vote counted then,
mm-hmm.
but file provisional ballots. And these brave people, many of whom had been waiting 8 or 9 hours at the time, refused to accept them. I'm told that not a one of them accepted it. That's how these people fought for their right to vote. And I, you know, as my email circulated, when it gets to other people who were voter protection volunteers, either in Ohio or on hotlines that took, they all would write to me and tell me stories and stuff. Now, one guy was an outside poll watching volunteer, and he was telling me about, you know, he was in an African American neighborhood in Cleveland, and the line was about 5 hours, and he was describing it graphically to me about how I didn't even think of this, but people had their kids with them and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And people just were sitting on the floor, and the line would hardly move. And the people from the neighborhood, the women from the neighborhood, were bringing them food and water and toilet paper. And the women from the neighborhood, some of them, as they'd be doing this, they would be weeping for these people and for what they were being put through. About 10 o'clock at night, a news crew finally showed up and started asking whether these ladies from the neighborhood who were bringing them food and water and toilet paper were doing it in order to influence the outcome of the election. Showing like how the media are like so in the pocket of the Republicans. It's unbelievable. But lines of 4 or 5 hours were the order of the day throughout the African many of the African American neighborhoods, especially in Cleveland and Columbus.
Now, you also write there was a problem with the touchscreen voting machines in Youngstown, Ohio.
Yeah, in Mahoning County, we got calls all day long about it. So how come? Why should there be more than one call about it? Because at that point, the machines should have been taken out of commission. But they were calling all day long about the touchtone thing, and it was strangely enough, it was exactly that weird thing that was going around the internet. Like as a joke, because, I mean, everybody knew if they were going to meddle with the computers, like, why would they do something visible? They would do something invisible. Mm-hmm. But it was actually that. They were pressing Kerry, and it was coming up Bush. Then the black neighborhoods were blanketed with postcards advising them of incorrect polling places. And then some of these people would believe it because they made it look like it was from the Democratic Party. And then the people would go to the wrong place, and maybe by the time they got to the right place, it would be too late. And maybe they wouldn't find out for 4 or 5 hours until after the polls were closed. So, I mean, I didn't know the reason this was going on, but I heard later that a number of polling places were closed and changed at the last minute. Mm-hmm. You'll see only in black neighborhoods.
I also wanted to ask you about challengers. I saw a short clip on the internet of somebody who was documenting challengers at an African-American polling place where the majority of voters were African-American, and they were actually hassling people and advising them how to vote.
Right, exactly.
Did you hear about any of this?
Yes. Now, it didn't happen to the volume that was anticipated. In other words, it was thought there were going to be 3,600 Republican challengers, and in every place they go, they're going to be hassling people. Well, some of them didn't show up. And some of them didn't conduct themselves improperly, but some of them did everything that was feared. Like it was illegal for them to talk to a voter, but yet they were doing it, and they were being permitted by the polling officials to do it. They were confronting and harassing voters. Then even those who weren't, improperly directly confronting and harassing the voters, were filing fraudulent challenges. Like they would just put blanket challenges with no basis for it. Like one African-American woman called me. She lived in the same place all her life, and she'd always voted in the same place since she'd been voting. And she was forced to answer questions about her citizenship. And under the law, if a challenge is filed on any particular basis, the Ohio law has a specific prescribed oath that has to be administered, which is kind of a lengthy oath. And then there are certain specific questions that have to be asked. In other words, the polling official will be breaking the law if there was a challenge to a voter for citizenship and didn't take at least, I would say it would take 3, 4, 5 minutes just to go through the oath and the questions. Mm-hmm. And each time someone does that, that's someone who's not there to help people with the voting machine. Like, one place where there were very long lines, they were saying it was one of the voters thought it was because they didn't have anybody to deal with these challenges. So the clerk was, every time there was a challenge, the clerk was taken away from processing people through regular voting. And one lady told me how she had next to her name, she'd never been arrested in her life, and she had next to her name SOS felony. And she was calling me to find out what SOS meant. And she noticed that a lot of her neighbors also had felony next to their names.
Now, what were you able to do for people like that? Could that person vote on a provisional ballot if they had felon next to their name?
Well, the clerk knew that it was bogus. In this particular woman's case, she was allowed to vote because mm-hmm. the clerk knew that it was bogus.
I see.
I couldn't help people at all. I mean, I could give them advice or something. I could tell them, no matter what the clerks tell you, file a provisional ballot. Don't let them tell you you can't.
I see.
But constantly, clerks were telling people, how many people got to talk to someone like me to tell them that.
Beckerman says some precincts in Cincinnati turned all voters away for no reason. He took calls from voters who were turned away from the polls because they had recently moved, and he discovered a new voting law in place.
So in the University of Cincinnati, you know, there were a lot of new voters because there was a big voter registration drive among the students. Mm-hmm. So when they went to vote, even though they were duly registered and their name and signature were in the roll book, they weren't allowed to vote. They were forced to file provisional ballots.
And the reason was?
No reason.
No reason.
Just because they were new voters. In other words, the clerks were making up a new law of their own. You got to understand, the whole Republican, the whole election machinery there is in the hands of Republicans. It's like a strange law which provides that the Secretary of State gets to appoint the entire Board of Elections for each place.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever receive any calls then or find out later about any irregularities with the machines themselves from any poll workers?
Just Mahoning County. That was the only one that I took. But remember, number one, there were, let's say, 19 other volunteers on this hotline.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, there were a number of other hotlines, some of which were much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Like there are 2,800 complaints from Ohio. The PFAW Election Protection Hotline has made their complaints public, and they have their database is up on the web. So if you go to if you click on Ohio, you get 2,800 complaints there.
Mm-hmm.
If you read that stuff carefully, you'll be in tears by the end of it when you realize what these people, the way these people were humiliated and disenfranchised. It's really a very, very sad commentary. And I just hope there are some honest prosecutors who are going to prosecute the people who did this stuff, because a lot of crime was committed in Ohio.
That was Ray Beckerman, a New York City attorney who took calls from Ohio voters for the Ohio Democratic Party hotline. You can find his article on the subject at www.spectrum2.com. Since November 2nd, several studies have questioned the disconnect between the exit polls that favored Kerry and the final vote that favored Bush. Some suggest the media has been complicit in trying to explain it. On BuzzFlash.com, you can see how CNN altered their exit poll data between 1 a.m. and 6 a.m. to match the final results. At 1:05 a.m., CNN reported that Kerry won 51% of the male vote and 53% of the female vote. By 6:41 a.m., they had flipped the exit poll results to read Bush winning 52% of the male vote and 50% of the female vote. The most recent study questioning the numbers was published last Thursday by researchers at UC Berkeley, who found that in Florida, discrepancies in the tallies appear only in counties with a certain kind of electronic voting, and that e-voting machines may have awarded up to 260,000 more votes to Bush than statistically possible. Members of blackboxvoting.org have been physically visiting each county in Florida searching for the actual vote. Bev Harris, who has been investigating e-voting machines and their pitfalls for several years, has launched the largest Freedom of Information Act request in history, asking for thousands of poll tapes. Blackboxvoting.org reported on the Portland, Oregon indie media site of just one of the smoking guns they have found so far. Last Tuesday in Volusia County, Florida, when Harris arrived to pick up the data she requested, she was given unsigned new printouts dated November 15th. She insisted on seeing the original signed poll tapes and was sent to a warehouse. At the warehouse, Harris was quickly barred from entry, but found many of the records she sought in a trash bag in front of the warehouse. And she found more after some dumpster digging in the back. For the whole story, go to Portland's Indy Media Center and check out blackboxvoting.org for updates as Harris's investigation continues. Finally, presidential candidates David Cobb of the Green Party and Michael Badnarik of the Libertarian Party have raised $150,000, enough to demand a recount in Ohio. The recount is expected to take place as soon as the vote there is certified. Meanwhile, hearings continue by groups like Common Cause to hear the frustrated cries of Ohioans who had no voice on voting day. Coming up, Liza Featherstone reads from her new book, We're Coming to You from the Trenches.
Walmart is Fortune magazine's most admired company for 2 years running. Its $245 billion in sales makes it the largest company anywhere. Its sales are greater than the gross domestic product of Switzerland. Last year, 82% of American households bought something at a Walmart. It is the largest employer in 21 states. In fact, after the federal government, Walmart is the largest employer in America with more than 925,000 employees. Each year, the company hires 550,000 more employees. That's three times the number of people the U.S. military recruits every year. Freelance journalist Liza Featherstone is the author of Selling Women Short, The Landmark Battle for Workers' Rights at Walmart. On November 9th, Liza Featherstone read from her book at Women and Children First Books on North Clark Street in Chicago. Featherstone described how Walmart's corporate success comes at a great cost to its workers. She began by reminding us of the TV commercials that we see every day.
It's not easy to have a family and a career, says the woman in the commercial earnestly. But my company makes it a lot easier. My company takes family very seriously. The woman, Margaret, is shown at home, spending relaxed quality time with her husband and children. Beginning in mid-2003, the American TV viewer was bombarded with advertisements like this one from a very surprising source, Walmart. The commercials were light on details. Margaret, a district manager for the retail chain, which is a very demanding job, never says what Walmart does exactly to help her balance motherhood with her job, but inspiringly upbeat. In a similar ad, a middle-aged black woman talks about her successful career as a Walmart department manager, smilingly pronouncing it a company of great opportunity for women. The woman says she is so pleased with her Walmart career that she urged her daughter to apply for a job with the company. Now both mother and daughter are enthusiastic members of the Walmart family. Had the nation's favorite retailer shed its famously conservative music-censoring image and embraced a women's rights agenda? Not yet. These ads were part of a concerted attempt by the company to stave off a public relations disaster, a disaster personified by a woman who actually looks very much like the happy, nameless department manager in the commercial, but whose experience working for Walmart was exactly the opposite. That woman was Betty Dukes, a 54-year-old Walmart worker in Pittsburgh, California. Like her TV counterpart, she is African-American and came to Walmart hoping to succeed. She was attracted by the idea of opportunity for women. She was first hired by the company in 1994 as a part-time cashier at $5 an hour. She was an eager employee with a sincere admiration for founder Sam Walton's visionary spirit. And a year later, she had excellent performance reviews. She was given a merit pay raise, and her part-time job turned into a full-time job. 2 years after that, she was promoted to the position of customer service manager, which sounds very lofty. Walmart does this a lot. It's an hourly position, but they give you the word manager in the title so that you feel more important. She began encountering harsh discrimination from her superiors. She says she was denied the training she needed to advance further, and that same training was given to male employees, many of whom were younger and newer to the company. When Dukes complained about the discrimination, her managers got back at her by writing her up for minor offenses, like returning late from breaks, offenses that were routinely committed by her white and male coworkers, and they were never punished. When she kept complaining, she was denied a promotion and eventually demoted back to her cashier jobs. She went to the Walmart district office to complain, but the company did nothing. Being demoted was not only humiliating, it also disqualified her from other promotions. And her cashier job offered fewer hours and a lower hourly wage. when she was again eligible for promotion for new management positions, which had never even been announced, never been posted, were filled by men. In late spring 2000, she filed a claim against the company. And the next year, she became the lead plaintiff in Duke's versus Walmart Stores, which is a class action representing 1.6 million women, as you just heard, past and present employees of the company. And that suit was filed in June 2001, and it charges the company with discriminating against women in promotions, pay, and job assignments, basically for violating the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which says you cannot discriminate against workers based on sex, race, religion, or national origin. And now Betty is a Baptist pastor. She's a very, very religious woman. And she uses a story from Scripture to explain her case to fellow churchgoers who are mostly elderly and black. They understand David and Goliath, she says. I tell them, Betty Dukes versus Walmart is like David versus Goliath. And it's true that the biblical David could never have anticipated a Goliath of this scale. Topping the Fortune 500 in both 2002 and 2003, and again this year, Walmart is the world's largest retailer. Its sales totaled $244.5 billion last year. And just to put that in perspective, it dominates the retail sector overwhelmingly. It's much more than twice the size of its largest U.S. competitor, Home Depot. In this lawsuit, Walmart has defended itself by arguing that stories like Betty's stem from a few bad managers, a few knuckleheads, as those were the exact words of a Walmart spokeswoman, Mona Williams, last year, summing up the complex legal argument. It's a few knuckleheads. And unfortunately, as the numbers show, Betty's experience is hardly an isolated one. Women make up the majority of Walmart workers, but just over a third of the salaried management. And in fact, the percentage of women among Walmart management in 1999, 34.5%, was less than that of its competitors in 1975. So, you know, long before there was that much consciousness in the business world about women's rights. Women are also paid less than men in nearly every position at the company. They also work in a startlingly hostile atmosphere. As you heard earlier, some of it is just really extraordinary. Kathleen McDonald, a candy clerk who's still working for Walmart in Aiken, South Carolina, asked her supervisor why her male coworkers made more money than she did. He gave her a creatively theological answer. God made Adam first, so women will always be second to men. Women in management are also told in many different ways that they don't belong. Melissa Howard, a store manager in Indiana, a store manager is the highest rank within a Walmart store that you can achieve. She had to attend business meetings at Hooters restaurants and visit strip clubs on business trips. She was eventually driven from her job by a district manager who felt that a woman with children shouldn't be managing a Walmart store. And this was something he actually said. It wasn't just like he thought that and found some other reason to get rid of her. I mean, these things are very often actually stated. The lawsuit reflects what Walmart represents, an increasingly prevalent business model in which every principle, including workplace fairness and equality, is sacrificed to one objective, which is giving the customer the lowest price. That's why Walmart's wages are so low, just over $8 an hour, and Walmart workers must pay more than a third of their own health insurance premiums. That's also why, in at least 40 states, Walmart has been accused of violating federal overtime laws. Workers have been encouraged to clock out and keep working. Sometimes managers lock the doors at the end of the shift and wouldn't let the employees go home. So given this single-minded focus on low prices and profits and the wage discrimination against the female workers, it's perhaps not surprising that many Walmart workers must depend on public assistance, food stamps, state health insurance, to get by. When we stand at the checkout line at Walmart, we may notice how much money we're saving, but we rarely consider that we may be paying, quite literally, in other ways. The public costs and the tax dollars that Walmart costs you don't appear on your receipt. Despite the fact that ordinary working people are the most hurt by Walmart's practices, the company sells itself actually as a champion of the ordinary person. And indeed, kind of a personification of the ordinary person. Even today, when 5 of the 10 richest individuals in the world are close relatives of the Walmart founder, Sam Walton, it is still possible for Brenda Barrera, a call center worker in the company headquarters, who I interviewed on the town square of Bentonville, where Walmart is headquartered, right in front of the Walton's original Five and Dime store. She insisted to me that the Waltons are just normal people. They're just like you and me. And central to Walmart's commitment to ordinary folk is a promise of advancement. The company constantly assures workers that Walmart is a place of great opportunity and mobility, a place where hard work and sacrifice will be rewarded. One of the plaintiffs in Dukes versus Walmart, a woman named Cleo Page, who worked at Walmart stores in Oklahoma and California, said that her district managers would tell you in the meetings, "I started out as a pushcart person." She recalls, "I'm thinking, wow, if they did it, then I can too." Each store has a picture of its store manager on the wall, and Cleo Page imagined hers would be hanging up on the wall one day. Another plaintiff in the lawsuit, Edith Arana, who worked just outside Los Angeles, agrees, "The impression I got was, as long as you work hard, there's nothing you can't do in this company." The interesting thing about Dukes versus Walmart is it is in itself a product of this company culture. The plaintiffs believed so fervently in Walmart's promises, and the lawsuit originates in their disappointment. To Betty Dukes, who still works at Walmart, she's a greeter now, that's the person who welcomes you to Walmart and when you leave, thanks you for shopping at Walmart. Walmart's rhetoric of opportunity rankles. "If you portray yourself to be a great place to work, a great place to grow and strive," she says, "then that's what you ought to be. They have not lived up to their great reputation." Edith Arana says when she worked at Walmart, she encouraged other women's faith in the Walmart culture. Her coworkers would complain about being asked to go beyond their duties. Arana says she would tell them, "Just do it with a smile," assuring them that someday they'd be rewarded with a promotion. I'd say, "Don't worry about it. Just go on and do it, because these are sacrifices that pay off in the end." Even as she was having her own doubts about Walmart's promises, she says, she tried to be upbeat when talking with her coworkers. But when she realized her own promotion, so often promised, was never going to come, she felt guilty about having encouraged so many other women to believe in the company. Being a plaintiff in this lawsuit is her way of making up to her coworkers. She is still deeply pained, feeling that she deceived them by being such a company booster. "Somebody has to stand up," she says. "I'll take that responsibility." Every day I keep picturing these women. They may not have the strength or the will to stand up to the company, but right now I do. She continues, "If I can stop one person from feeling a percentage of the humiliation that I felt, then I will feel good about that because of all the times that I didn't say something." She also feels embarrassed about having believed the Walmart promises. And a lot of women have echoed this. "I'm telling you," Arana says now, "I felt extremely used. I felt ashamed because I would have to tell somebody, I just went along with it. I can just see people being like, oh, duh." She compares Walmart to a bad boyfriend. "Despite all the disappointing things he does, you keep remembering when you first met him, and you keep on giving him another chance." "And that's how we get caught up," she continues. "They tell you exactly what you want to hear. But then you fall out of love and feel you were basically played."
That was Liza Featherstone, author of Selling Women Short, The Landmark Battle for Workers' Rights at Walmart. She spoke on November 9th at Women and Children First Books in Chicago. From the trenches, I'm Kelly Pierce.
At the Nuclear Power and Children's Health Conference that was held in Chicago in October, much of the focus centered around the past, present, and future human and planetary costs of nuclear power. But one speaker offered a brighter alternative to a future with nuclear power. Harvey Wasserman, a veteran anti-nuclear and environmental activist, is a senior editor of the Free Press. Wasserman says wind power alone can supply all of America's electricity.
Wind power now blows nuclear power away. No one will ever build a nuclear power plant in this country or on this earth with the hope of gaining a legitimate profit. There is no way that nuclear power can compete with wind energy in current prices. Now, the federal government may step in, or some other governments in India or China or wherever may step in. They're done with it in Europe, but they may step in, or except for Finland, I suppose, but they may step in and build nuclear power plants with federal money or government money. And of course, we will have to stop that. I believe we can stop it. But the reality is that no one who is legitimately interested in profit will ever build another nuclear plant for one simple reason. Wind power is cheaper. Nuclear power can no longer compete with commercial-scale wind power. The reality is, the basic reason is, there is one simple fact that Ronald Reagan overlooked when he tried to kill the wind power industry in this country and in this world in the 1980s, and it boils down to one word, Denmark. The fact of the matter is that we had, in the 1980s, really in the late 1970s, the United States had the unchallenged lead in wind power on this planet. Thanks to Jerry Brown putting in those tax credits in California, there were 17,000 windmills built in California in the late 1970s and early 1980s. About half of them worked. About half of them were scams for tax credits, but that's kind of the way it goes. And at that time, the United States had 95% of the wind-generated electricity in the world. It was marginally cost-effective. And I suppose at the time, the industry, if it didn't calculate on accidents and environmental impacts and on waste storage and all the other stuff they never talk about, I suppose they could say that wind power was more expensive than nukes, but it is no longer even in the ballpark. Even the least optimistic people who talk about commercial-scale wind power these days say it's 4 cents a kilowatt hour or cheaper. We do not need a Manhattan Project for wind power. Wind power is here. It's been here. They may improve it. They'll certainly improve it. But they're going to get it down to maybe 2 cents, maybe a cent and a half. There's going to be a limit below which they can't get it. The reality is now it blows away nuclear power, it blows away coal, it blows away natural gas, which is running on short supply, and it certainly blows away oil. There is no cheaper way to produce additional electrical generating capacity in the United States today than building wind power, certainly west of the Mississippi. Now, it's been said, and I have Arjun Makajani's beautiful latest piece here about wind, and it's been said and it's been proven for a long time that west of the Mississippi we have at least three times a capacity, wind capacity, to generate at least three times as much electricity as the United States uses today. At least three times. In the states of North Dakota, Kansas, and Texas alone, we have enough wind capacity to generate 100+% of all the electricity consumed in the United States today. That is a simple fact. It's an undisputable fact. The fact of the matter is that the technology has been improving. To do a little historical detour here, the first known windmill to operate in what became the United States of America was actually constructed in the 1660s in Manhattan by the Dutch. I found this out by a guy who is even more frenetic than me, who is the head of the Wind Energy Trade Association in Copenhagen. He says, "You Americans are crazy." He pulls out this book. He shows me a wind cut of a windmill in Manhattan in the 1660s. So we are no strangers to wind power on this continent. And it's old technology. It's been around a long, long time. In the 70s, I think a lot of us thought that photovoltaic cells would come first and that all the rooftops would be covered with PV and the wind would come second. But we overlooked two things. First of all, there's many, many centuries of history with wind power. And secondly, wind power is basically simple stuff. It is not rocket science. There are not a whole hell of a lot of moving parts, even in your very large windmills. Now, for your scientific edification, I've done some schematic drawings of windmills here. Basically, the technology is pretty well set. Three blades into the wind. There's a wonderful guy named Paul Gipe. If you're interested in the technology, G-I-P-E. He's had some books published by Chelsea Press. He's a total curmudgeon, wonderfully disagreeable. And basically he says, and Dan Jewell says, and I think most people agree, that it's going to be three blades into the wind. That's the technology we're going to have. There are vertical access machines. There are machines that are being put on rooftops. Probably not. It's probably all going to be one big tower with three blades. There are basically two kinds of windmills that are going to be with us for a long period, big ones and little ones. Now, the little ones, you see around houses, there are a couple of companies, the Bergey, B-E-R-G-E-Y, which is a family business out of Oklahoma. There's Southwest out of Arizona. There are a few others entering the field. These small windmills work. They're good for home and garden, basically. We thought originally maybe there'd be a lot of windmills in the suburbs. I don't think that's going to happen. The wind is too turbulent, and the windmills don't make much noise anymore, but they make enough to be an annoyance in most suburbs. You will not see, I don't think, a lot of windmills in suburbs. You will see them on small ranchettes. Like, by the way, George Bush does not have a ranch. It's a ranchette. It used to be a pig farm, and according to Jim Hightower, he can't ride a horse. Oh, God. Anyway, so... getting back to wind power, the big ones are the ones that are the future of wind power in terms of us fighting nuclear power. We have had tremendous breakthroughs in wind power in the last 10 years. Really, the major breakthroughs came in the mid-1990s when the Dutch really got their feet under the technology. There were four large companies the four large Danish companies, they've now merged, there are three. Micon recently took over Vestas or vice versa. We call them Mestas. There's one in Germany, Enercon. There's one in Spain, Gamesa. Mitsubishi in Japan. There's a new one now coming out of India, Suzlon. The Chinese will probably enter with their own. But basically, there are going to be 10 companies in the world or so that build large windmills. And the big ones have made tremendous progress. One of the most important pieces of progress they've made has been in my home state of Ohio. I live in Columbus. Nobody ever thought wind power would work in Ohio. Suddenly, and they were right, actually, until 2 years ago. 2 years ago, the city of Bowling Green, which not accidentally has a municipal power company, decided to put up two large 1.8 megawatt machines. In other words, 500 of them would totally displace the capacity of a nuclear plant. These machines could not have been erected profitably 5 years ago because the wind in northern Ohio, basically where they put them, is class 3. Best is class 7, acceptable for wind power, had been class 5. Then it got, as the windmills got better, it went down to class 4. Now it's at class 3. Vestas put up two very big 270-foot towers with a propeller housing, which is called a nacelle, three blades into the wind. The blades, I think, are, well, they have to be less than the size of the tower, obviously, so they're not that much less. You got to be able to, the wind, they have to be short, they have to miss the ground by the height of a tall cow. So, but other than that, they're really big. So basically, a year ago, September, these two windmills went in, 1.85 megawatts each, and we now have a year of data, and they are ahead of projections. So they are operating profitably. You figure it's $1 million a megawatt for a windmill, so they cost $1.8 million each. They're going to put up two more. Their principal customers are other municipals. And this is a political issue that I'm going to get into right now, because now that we've established that wind power is the future, and it is, it would only take several hundred thousand, at most, windmills west of the Mississippi to completely supply all the electricity west of the Mississippi. We're also going to talk about offshore, which is coming next. But the reality is that there is one American manufacturer left in the business. Guess who it is? General Electric. There was, sorry to say that, bearer of bad news, don't blame me, but at first it was Zond. I mean, Reagan, you know, in the late 70s when Jimmy Carter came in, there was a boom in renewables. There were tens of thousands of people working in the renewable energy industry. We had all sorts of wind power companies looking to the future. One of them, Zond, in Tehachapi, California, stood out. They seemed like they were going to have the lead. Then they were bought by guess who? Enron. And when Enron went down, Zond was just about the only division they had left that was making any money. And Zond actually made a good windmill, and a fair windmill, I'd say. It wasn't as good as most of the Danish machines, but it was okay. It was competitive. And when Enron went down, General Electric bought them. So General Electric inherited Enron's wind business, which originated with Zond, and they are now really the only major manufacturer of large-scale commercial-grade windmills in the country. Now, by and large, they seem to be pretty good. Technically, but it makes me very uncomfortable to have the primary or one of the two primary nuclear guys also owning our number one wind manufacturing company. This is something we're going to have to face. You know, we can no longer go out there and just blankly advocate wind. Wind is a business. I'll tell you a little story. I went to my first wind power conference a couple years ago. I was all excited. You know, I dressed in my usual rags, showed up expecting to see a couple thousand hippies, and I walked in, and I thought it was a banker's convention. There were 1,699 guys in suits and me. I mean, it is a big business. There are very large corporations involved in the wind industry now, and if you go to any trade show involving wind power, it is very, very corporate. And that's one of the things also I want to talk about. So we now have General Electric dominating. They make two machines. They make an on-land 1.5 megawatt machine, which is supposed to be very good. And, you know, if you go into the wind business and you want to buy a machine, you might want to buy one from General Electric. They're domestic, and they maintain them. When your windmill goes down, you got to have somebody to call, and GE is probably as good as anybody to call. But the other thing that's really happening is they're one of the only two that's building the offshore machines. Nobody really knows the capacity of the wind offshore. We've continually been upgrading the capacity on land. As the satellite mapping improves and as we learn other things about how to figure out how much wind there is, it appears there's more and more. And so we have a good convergence because we're finding more wind and we're also building wind machines that are more capable of using less wind. The wind machines in Bowling Green are bigger than they've ever been. Like I say, the 270 feet off the ground, and they're slower. It used to be you had to get certain RPMs per minute. Now you can have less. And that means that you can harvest less wind more profitably, and that's why we can now have wind power in northern Ohio, which should very rapidly displace that goddamn Davis-Bessie nuclear plant as fast as we possibly can, but that's another story. So GE is also building an offshore machine, 3.5 megawatts. One of the Danish companies is also building an offshore machine. We'll probably see Mitsubishi get into it, but it's big, big money and big, big investment. Now, the good news is that we don't know how much offshore wind there is, but there seems to be a virtually limitless supply. So not only can we generate three times as much electricity as the United States uses, but with windmills west of the Mississippi, but we also probably can generate that much again with windmills not only offshore on the coasts, but also in the Great Lakes. And we have found now the latest wind maps that come out show class 7 wind in the middle of Lake Erie, which is the best wind you can get. And very clearly, the wind capacity in the middle of the Great Lakes is going to be huge. The Great Lakes are good in a certain sense because they're shallow and they're not that far from big cities. And there's certainly less turbulence there than in many places in the oceans. So we're going to see huge breakthroughs. Unfortunately, as far as I'm concerned, it's all going to be corporate owned. You can't actually, not many small farmers in the middle of Lake Erie are going to be putting up land behind their house. But that's something, again, we're going to have to deal with. We have to go very carefully at that. For example, we're now seeing, and people are, go shake their heads, opposition to the wind farm in the Golden Triangle between Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. And Bobby Kennedy Jr. has been in the forefront of that opposition. And many of us who are in the wind, promoting wind, think this is, well, it's mixed. I believe that scenic issues are legitimate issues. If people don't want to look at windmills, they have the right to at least vote on not looking at them. And if they lose and they go up. If they don't, then the other issues which are important to mention are bird kill and noise. The noise issue has basically disappeared. You get a swooshing from the blades, but there's really the turbine itself no longer makes noise that's noticeable. That's gone. And onshore, because the noise is so limited, the people who are going to hear the noise are the ones who are making the money off of it. So it pretty much works out. Nobody a reasonably short distance away from even a very large windmill is going to hear it anymore, and that's not a problem. Bird kill is a legitimate issue in certain areas, very, very limited areas. There are places where you cannot put windmills. Narrow migratory zones are basically the ones. They managed in California to build the among the some of the first windmills at Altamont Pass in California, scene of that terrible Rolling Stones concert, and that is a bad place for windmills. You got birds flying through, it's tight, they can't get around, and a lot of birds of prey, raptors, have been killed there. Of course, now the Cato Foundation has taken that one spot and taken the number of dead birds per windmill and multiplied that by all the birds in the world and all the windmills in the world and proven that windmills will kill every bird on the planet. It's very touching to see the industry so worried about birds now, especially after what happened at Three Mile Island. But the reality is that in Kansas, in Nebraska, and offshore, these windmills are big, they're slow. It will take very suicidal birds to get killed. By, you know, we could probably spread Prozac around the area and avoid any bird kill whatsoever. And my buddy Dan Jewell has 17 windmills on his property in southwestern Minnesota and has yet to have a bird kill. One of the major factors is that the towers are now different. The original towers in California were pretty much all latticework erector set towers. And the birds of prey would perch on them, and they would spot a groundhog or a squirrel or something, and they'd dive through, and they'd get clunked by the blades. All the towers now are tubular. They're slightly more expensive to build up front, but they build them that way because there's virtually no maintenance. And the birds can't perch. So that problem has been solved, and I'm a bit angry at the Audubon Society and the opponents of the Cape Wind project for saying that bird kill will be involved, because offshore it's virtually non-existent. You are very, very unlikely that there will be significant bird kill on any offshore wind on wind machines. The visual impact, okay, we can argue about, but as far as I'm concerned, and this is crucial for our discussion, it's an ownership issue. You know, it's great to advocate wind power, and we're all going to do it, and we all feel that wind power is better than nukes, of course. But the question then becomes, who owns these machines? These machines are very, very profitable. There is going to be a huge amount of money made in wind power. Now, if you want to invest in wind power, you don't have to do it through GE. There are other places. Do the three blades into the wind. Don't look at the so-called, so far the vertical axis guys don't work. Machines perched on top of buildings, too much turbulence. It's the freestanding, big tower, three blade into the wind machines that are going to make the money, and they make huge amounts of money. And what bothers me about the Cape Wind project is that it's privately owned. We have windmills going in off the south part of Long Island. The people there are every bit as rich, as every bit as finicky. There was opposition, but that project is owned by LIPA, the Long Island Power Authority. For all its problems, it's still public owned. Okay? Now, what's happening in this country to the wind business is very interesting and indicative and may have an impact on nuclear. It's not clear yet, but it could. 50% of the windmills being built and installed in the United States are now being built by General Electric. Now, that can be problematic. That's a discussion. But they really just provide the wind machines. 50% of the projects also are being developed by FPL Energy, which is a subsidiary of Florida Power and Light, which happens to own four nuclear plants and has no wind power whatsoever in Florida. And what they do is that they go in and they pay a royalty to wind farmers. You know, they come in and say, hi, these old farmers, they say, hi, we want to buy your wind rights. And the guy goes, sure, you know. And they sell them, and they're worth a fortune. And then they're getting, it's like the old oil wildcatters or whatever, selling mineral rights that the farmers, or buying mineral rights that the farmers didn't know the true value of. So what we are doing, I'm working with Dan Jewell, the guy in southwestern Minnesota. He figured this out, and basically what we're trying to do is show farmers how to build their own wind farms. And we believe in the long run, this will give, first of all, they'll make 10 to 20 times as much money. The average lease payment that a wind developer pays to a farmer on whose land they build a windmill is $2,000 to $3,000 a year per machine. But if the farmer owns the windmill, he or she can make 20 to 30 grand per machine. And more after 10 years when the principal's paid off. So the reality is that what we're trying to do is build a network of farmers who own their own wind farms and give it a community base. The other part of it is that the best utilities that are involved in the wind business now are the municipals, not surprisingly. And those of you who don't think we've had an impact, in 1989, as you'll remember, thanks to NIRS and SEC and Helen and so many other people campaigning, the city of Sacramento, which had a municipal utility, voted to shut the Rancho Seco nuclear plant. First time it happened in history, June of 1989. And guess what happened the day after they voted? It shut. Amazing. No 20 years of court battles, none of this, none of that, because they owned it. Now, Sacramento, as a municipal, has now gone ahead and invested in wind power. They've done solar. They've done conservation. They're doing all the green stuff. If you want to find a poster child for a utility, Sacramento Municipal Utility Company is it, SMUD. Now, the reason we got wind power in northern Ohio is not just because wind power finally became profitable, but because a municipal utility did it. The city of Bowling Green has a municipal utility. Now, would First Energy, dare I say the name, the owner of the Davis-Bessey nuclear plant, chime in and cooperate? Would they buy in the power? Hell no. They won't touch it. They've got Davis-Bessey, they've got Perry. They don't want their nuclear investments messed with. So what Bowling Green had to do was pull together its own consumer base from other municipal utilities. And as a result of that, they've been able to sell their power, their cheaper power, to their fellow munis, and they're now going to build two more big windmills. And that's absolutely crucial. If you're interested, really, in pushing this and in pushing wind power in your community, the first step to take is to get a municipal utility in place, because that's where the real market is. So the reality then becomes, if we can own some of this wind power, if farmers can build their own wind farms, which we've shown we can. One of the reasons I have Dan's website up there is Dan and I, he asked me to come with him and write a handbook on how to do that. So all of you who own a couple of sections of land in Kansas, see me afterwards and I can show you exactly how to do it. It is a remarkable, revolutionary process, and it's really happening fast, and it's immensely profitable. So now the upshot is that if we can have a network of people across the United States building and operating and owning their own wind farms, we will be able to get out from under some of this commercial load from these ridiculous nuclear plants, which operate far less efficiently. Now, the reality is that because wind is intermittent, a megawatt of wind power will only generate about 333 usable megawatts the way they scale it. So basically, for capacity, you have to build three times as many much windmill capacity as allegedly you have to build nuclear capacity. But, of course, that's on the presumption that the nukes are going to operate 100% of the time, which we know is a total drug fantasy. We have 14 nukes around Chicago. Zion is gone, and another one's gone, so we're down to 11. And at no time that I've ever been here has more than half of them been operating. So that's a myth. But to fill the thumbnail sketch of what the utilities expect, you got to build three times as much new capacity as they have. But even at that, it comes in at $3 million a megawatt. There is nowhere on this planet that you can build a nuclear plant or even start to talk about building a nuclear plant for $3 million a megawatt. It ain't going to happen. So the reality is that nukes are being blown away by wind power. And if ever you're in an argument and they want to tell you that a nuke is cheap, forget it. We have won that battle. It's over. Economically, in strict terms of dollars and cents, in strict terms of profitability, we are in the age of wind power. How big is the industry? In 2001, in Texas alone, and someone unmentionable had just been governor there, they built $900 million worth of windmills, 900 megawatts. The American wind industry and the world wind industry have been growing at a rate of 25 to 30% a year. It is now, by all standards of calculation, a $5 to $10 billion a year industry worldwide, and at the rate of 30% a year, it will double and triple in the next 10 years easily. So many, many, many more megawatt hours of wind capacity are being installed on this planet as we speak, as are new nuclear megawatts. And it will continue that way. The dollar argument is on our side. The free market is on our side. And all we got to do now is stop the governments from sticking in money, and nuclear power is dead, dead, dead.
That was Harvey Wasserman, senior editor of the Free Press, speaking at the Nuclear Power and Children's Health Conference in Chicago, October 16th. His web address is hw.com. From the Trenches is produced by Chicago's Independent Media Center. You can post your own stories, listen to this program again, find links to news and upcoming events in Chicago and around the world through our internet address. The address is www.chicago.indymedia.org. Listen again on the fourth Monday in December for another report from the Trenches.